All right. So we are here today with author Craig Danielson. However, most people are probably going to know you as Nick Cutter. And for those of you who may have stumbled in here by accident, Nick, can you tell us a little bit about who you, do you prefer Nick or Craig?
Well, I mean, Craig is the name that I'll answer to most readily, but you know, Nick is fine for certain in things like this. I'd be welcome. If you would prefer to call me Nick, I will happily answer that, Ed. So
I will try to go with Craig.
Okay. All right. The I write literary fiction under my own name, and about 10 years ago, I had this opportunity. I basically had this idea that was very clearly not of my regular sort of scope of work that I had done up until that point, even though I had grown up, you know, loving horror and always had hoped to be a part of that genre. And sat down and wrote on my first horror novel. Not my first horror novel. I wrote first under yet another pen name, and those were horror novels as well. But this one I wrote and sent off to my agent, and not really knowing what his reaction might be, because it was far afield from the sort of stuff that he had handled me with before. But he enjoyed it. We ended up being fortunate enough to sell it. And that has sort of kicked off this decade of writing as Nick Cutter in my own sort of like the genre that, again, I grew up reading and loving. So it's been a really wonderful decade, and long may it persist.
Nice. Now, did you just come up with that because it sounded cool, or is it just because Nick and Cutter are both things with blades?
Well, Nick is my son's name. He was two when Nick Cutter was born. He's 12 now. So, you know, I think at some point in his youth, he thought the honorific was pretty cool. Now he's turning into a teenager, and nothing I do is cool. And then the other side of it, I think me and my agent sat down and, you know, it's like, you know, you need a punchy declarative type of name. Hacker, slasher, Cutter. Okay, let's go with that. So, you know, I think it's funny, almost any pen name. My friend Andrew Piper now is writing under the pen name Mason Coyle, C-O-I-L-E. You know, and you sit down and like, where do these names come from? How much, you know, how much do they really matter, other than sort of to set a differentiation between, you know, the work that you wrote under your own name and this other, this other sort of like pen name that you're, I mean, I'm in the specific situation of my pen name now probably is more well known than me. So I now stand in the shadow of my own pen name, which is an interesting phenomenon, but I don't begrudge Nick for his, whatever success he's had.
Well, to be fair though, let's face it. You are the hardest author I have ever come across to find on social media.
Yeah, you're right. there was a time when I probably would have been a bit more, I feel like for most of us, it's either you're on or you're not, you know? And if you're on, you're on. I shouldn't say that. There are some people who are sort of semi on in that they have a presence, but it's, you know, sort of like a weedy garden that it's not really tended very often. And there's other people who are very online, and that suits their personalities and suits their sense of trying to get the word out about their books. But I just discovered that social media wasn't really my thing. And as such, I don't really engage in it very much. I certainly understand the value of it, and I don't have anything against it specifically, just the particular flavor didn't suit me. And so I'm not, you won't find me there. I do have a website. But you're right. No, I'm a ghostly presence, I suppose, on the internet in terms of my actual being able to reach me.
Yeah. And I was simply alluding to the fact that maybe that's why Nick is possibly a little bit more well known than Craig.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think, you know, horror fiction is, I may be going through a moment, although I think horror fiction has never not been, you know, sort of popular and as it should be. And I think also genre readers, to my mind, are pretty loyal. You know, they really have a certain sense of fealty to a given author or genre itself, you know, or even a subset of that genre. Like they really like zombie books or vampire books. Whereas literary fiction can be a little bit more, I don't know how to say it. You know, readers aren't don't necessarily exert that same level of loyalty for whatever reason. So it is what it is. It's just something I've noticed, I suppose, in my 20 years of writing.
No, I think you're right. A lot of, like, even for instance, even romance is a genre. I know a lot of people, they read everything by so-and-so or a group of so-and-sos.
Yeah.
But if it's just plain fiction, it's just like pick and choose whatever you want.
Yeah. If this one won some awards, if it's sort of the book of the moment, you know, people will flock to it. And I think, you know, I would, in the literary side of things, we here in Canada, we have each sort of literary festivals, which every fall, you know, there's like five or six that you know, you might get invited to or not. And you run into the person who had the book of the season last year or 2 years ago, and now their new book is out and it's not getting that same level of, and you feel poorly, obviously, for them, because it's, I'm sure the work itself is probably just as engaging and just as, you know, written with as much passion as the one that preceded it. But yeah, there is that catch as can. I mean, that's literature. I mean, that's sort of books in general, you know, sort of, there are very few writers who have a track record that doesn't have a sort of an up and down to it. But I would say the swings, it's like taking a bad beat at a poker table sometimes. It's like, I don't know, it was a pretty good hand. I liked it. Why, you know, why did it not, you know, sort of find favor? But, you know, I suppose that's just a job hazard more than anything, right? You know, we've chosen to do this job that certainly has its own, you know, again, hazards. And then you just sort of to accept being a writer is to accept to ride that roller coaster a little bit for most of us.
No, I get it. I don't think anybody writes more than two books without somebody somewhere going, well, this one wasn't as good as the other one.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. And that's probably, there's probably some, I'm not sure if there's truth to that or not, but the writers that we all love, you know, even them, you know, would, I mean, you know, but would have ones that probably, like, there's, if they've written 20 books, there's five that are seen as like the high watermark of that author's sort of output. But the other ones are all ideally like really readable and no one's throwing them across the room going, you know, how was I beguiled into reading this? But you're right. I think consistency is difficult and sort of, you know, measuring up to your last book or your last movie or whatever your creative endeavor is, your last art show, I suppose, if you're a sculptor or a painter, you know, your last album, if you're a musician, that's just a job hazard of the creative for most of us, for 99% of creatives. That's just something that we have to deal with. And, you know, there's always the next book, there's the next album, there's the next opportunity to sort of, you know, catch the lightning in the bottle, maybe.
Oh yeah. You just got to find your people. And I don't know if she coined it, but I remember her, Elizabeth Baer, said something about having author points. Basically, that's when you've built up enough of a reputation with a reader that even if they start to read another book of yours and they're like, I'm not sure about this, they're going to finish it to see what you did.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would certainly, that's a great point by Elizabeth. And I feel the same way with a writer who I admire or I've written quite a bit by them. Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe as a writer myself, I respect that, you know, there are certain writers who, and you know, they don't do this out of any sort of, I don't think crass commercialism or anything, but they, you know, sort of like, say, a detective novelist. It's like that novelist knows what his or her audience wants. That's what they're good at. And they sort of fulfill that obligation and, you know, sort of meet the audience where they want to, that sweet spot between the both of them, both as a writer offering something and a reader receiving it. But, you know, there are the odd writer who, you know, does something really different. I remember Robert R. McCammon, who is a writer who I greatly admire, you know, was writing horror books for a great while. And then I think he started doing stuff that was not quite horror and his publishers were perplexed and probably said, hey, go back to doing this thing that you were doing that, you know, we felt was more saleable. And, you know, he said no, essentially, and, you know, sort of did his own thing. And I think you can see from someone from a creative perspective, it's like you want to be able to follow your own muse as much as you can and write the things that you want to write. And so I admire, you know, a sort of a writer who just decides to do his or her own thing, be damned with, you know, sort of some of the reaction that they might face, you know, sort of making that choice.
Well, I mean, some of them knock it out of the park too, because let's face it, William Kent Kruger was absolutely known for the Cork O'Connor series. And then they didn't want him to write Ordinary Grace. He finally decided, I'm going to write Ordinary Grace. And that's probably his favorite book.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another great example, right, of someone who was, you know, pigeonholed in a way, I suppose, and probably could have continued, as said, to write that series and enjoy himself. And obviously readers would have enjoyed it. But yeah, there's quite a few like that, right, who just sort of take a, take a chance really, and, or follow the path that they feel is the most artistically fulfilling. I mean, to a degree, that's what I did. You know, I had grown up reading horror, loved horror, felt like I wanted to do something different. And I mean, all the risk is anyone going to, you know, buy it really? Is it going to be worth your effort sort of, as someone who makes their living as a writer? I mean, that's, I think that was the only even small concern I had. But I mean, the first book that I wrote under my own, under Nick Cutter, I wrote so quickly that it wasn't, you know what I mean? It's not like I spent 2 years on it and it's like, oh boy, now, you know, these bills are going unpaid and this thing better work out. Right. So, so yeah, and I would, you know, me personally, I'd love to write like a children's book, and maybe I will at some point. You know, there's nothing auguring against me doing that. So I certainly like people who try different things, and I think quite frankly, a lot of writers do. There are not too many who probably stay in the same lane their entire career, and if they do, I'm assuming they're doing it because they actually, you know, enjoy it and don't want to leave that lane.
Yeah, you'd think, although I do know a lot of authors, and of course, nobody wants to say this on camera in front of anything, but just like, you know, the Cork O'Connor series, if you get to a point where you're doing a series and it's doing really well, you're thinking, I've got all these other books I want to write, and the publisher's going, but I know this one will sell, like you said, sure. It's more saleable. It's hard to get the guys paying the bills to...
Well, that's right. I mean, you always say it's in the movie industry, you know, the actors always say it's one for them, one for me. That doesn't necessarily prevail quite as much in the publishing sphere, as at least as I found. I mean, you can do one for you, but you're probably not going to get an advance for it or much sort of, you know, sort of encouragement necessarily to do it. And you might, you know, be writing into the void and that you've written this book that, you know, your publishers are like, no, you know, this actually might sully your brand, I guess, in a way. So you're right. Yeah. And there might be some writers who just, I mean, again, I guess if you have but I always feel like you have a really well-established series like that. I mean, you can always go back to it. I don't know that there's too many readers who would be baying for your blood of like, I mean, you know, George R. R. Martin, maybe, get some flack because he's taken so long to write, you know, but even then, like, not that he gives a shit. But, you know, I think most readers are, you know, they would be accepting, you know, most times if a writer decides, okay, I'm going to try and do this thing over here. You're right, though, on the publishing side of it, they show a little less, you know, willingness.
Yeah. Well, and also, let's face it, George R. R. Martin probably has a little bit of leeway as long as Patrick Rothfuss keeps saying, hold my beer.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And he probably just, he's... so established and quite frankly, so old and, you know, old, I don't mean in a bad way, just like, you know, screw it. I don't really care what the online rabble is saying and bless him for that. Like, you know, he'll do it if he wants to. And if he doesn't, like, you know, I don't think he's losing any sleep over it.
No. Especially with the royalties from the movies or the TV show.
Yeah.
All right, well, we kind of hit the ground running. So let me just get a couple of questions out here just because I know aspiring authors also like to check that out. So the first thing that I always ask every author, what is your supervillain origin story?
Okay, and the background of this was, how did I get into writing?
Right. Why a writer out of all the stuff you could have done, your amateur boxing career, etc.?
Right. Well, there were certainly some days in the early years where I was, you know, you know, living on a bag of potatoes a week and barely affording my rent, that I probably wished I hadn't been a writer or chosen this path. But I think the easiest thing to say is that when I was a very apathetic and not particularly good high school student, and most of my teachers and most of my friends, for that matter, would not have forecasted any kind of like that I would ever have wrote anything that would be encased between two covers and put on a bookshelf at any point. But we had I went to school in Ontario, and when I was going there was actually grade 13. They thought our generation was such dullards that we needed an extra grade to make sure that we didn't all enter the workforce as complete clods. So in that grade 13 year, there was a creative writing course that one of the teachers sort of put together of her own volition. There, I don't think it was the only one in the entire city. And I went to like a technical school, so it was strange to have seen it there, but it was a little bit fortuitous for me, obviously. And I entered the class, and I'd done a bunch of reading. I loved reading. And I really applied myself, wrote some stories, and my teacher came up to me at some point, and I swear there was a broad look of shock on her face and said, "Craig, I be honest, you know, you seem to have some talent at this, and I'm as surprised as anybody, you know." But I, you know, she actually went and bought me an edition of the Writer's Digest back then, which at that point was this big, you know, with every place you could send a piece to, you know. And so that kind of support and encouragement at a really early age of my development was immeasurable. And you know, I've had a chance to Miss Jeffries. I've had a chance to thank her since, you know, for, you know, helping me down this path that I'm now on, and, you know, married with children, and, you know, have been doing it for, I guess, 2 decades now. But it started there. It started at West Park School in St. Catharines, Ontario, in the grade 13 creative writing class, when Miss Jeffries came up to me and said, "I'm shocked to be saying this, Craig, but you actually seem like you're not a bad writer."
Well, hey, you know, maybe you're not paying attention because your mind's elsewhere and you're dreaming dreams. And
you know what? It's like with my own children, you know, like I sort of counsel them that a lot of school is not stuff that you're going to need going forward, you know, but it's important to apply yourself anyways, just to learn the fundamentals of learning and paying attention. But when you find that thing that really galvanizes you, that thing that really seems to be hand in glove, you won't need any prompting. You know what I mean? I stayed up till 2 o'clock writing because I was fervently full of that desire to do that and to be that thing. And I think that most of us, it's a matter of sort of finding your thing. And when you find your thing, you pursue it. But until you find it, yeah, you're right. You can be sort of apathetic and you can be drifting and you can be aimless because you haven't really oriented on that pole star that pushes you to excel as well as you can towards that ambition that you've created for yourself.
I have to agree with you, though. I can't remember the last time I've had to solve for X. But you joke about having to stay in for 13 years. Let's face it, they're just going the opposite direction these days. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, they started kindergarten to get you ready for first grade. And then they invented pre-kindergarten to get you ready for kindergarten. So we're doing like 14 years now. We're just going pre.
Yeah. Even here in Toronto, we like the nursery schools have, you know, sort of like learning programs in them at 2 and 3. And I mean, I guess it's you're right. It's different from you and me finger painting and you know, gluing macaroni on construction paper. It's a bit more defined even in the tasks, but you're right. Yeah. So I guess maybe the people will be born as fetuses and immediately get a mortarboard stuck on their head and you graduated being born on to the next task.
Yeah. Congratulations on your birth. Here's your craft project. All right. Okay. And then the one thing before we get into the book, the one thing I always like to ask an author, is there anything for an aspiring author? Let's say you were given a chance to teach a class and you're going to have one class to teach them something that either somebody told you and made a huge difference or something you certainly wish somebody had taught you that would have made life easier becoming a writer.
Yeah, I've probably answered variants of this question in different ways. And it's a good question. And I'm sure in all the talks you've had with authors, there's a variety of answers. I would think that at least a percentage of them probably boil down to the idea that it's not going to happen unless you make it happen. You know, I think there is a sense out there of writing that it is glamorous, and that it is that the muse will take you and it will whisk you away, and it will sort of involve you and invite your mind into this passionate notion of what it is to write a book and to be creative. And maybe that is for some people. I can't speak for obviously everybody's journey and the way that it works, but for me, it's very unglamorous. And it has been from the beginning. It's very task oriented. It's very goal oriented, daily, weekly, monthly. You know what I mean? Like it's like a muscle that the more that you flex it continually, it will stay at the same size, and it will kind of produce the same general results. So me, it was like I told myself I needed to write 1,000 words a day. That became sort of the goal. And I'm a bit more lax on it now with the family and obligations, and I'm just getting older, and it's not something that is quite as, you know, I'm slavishly devoted to. But there was a point in my early writing career when I was still struggling that no matter what I was doing, no matter what time of the day, if I had to stay up until, 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes I was staying up and I was writing, like my 5,000th word, because I'd just really been, on a tear, on a heater. But other times it was like, no, I just need to get this done, and get it done in a way that felt fair and honest to myself. And then I could, go and get up the next day and do it all over again, basically. So yeah, I would say for me, there's an unglamorous part of writing, and there's some, obviously some lovely benefits of it, and getting just to do the thing that you like to do. And the thing that for me, as I've said already, Ed, that I, 18 years old, I, sort of made this decision that I wanted to try and be this. And so to sort of have managed to fulfill that at some level is really meaningful on its own. But it wasn't what it without effort, and it wasn't without like sort of the unglamorous nuts and bolts of just ass and chair kicking words out.
No, and I think that your take on it is a lot more commonplace than people think. Most of the time, if you've got somebody who only wants to write when the muse hits them, those are called unpublished authors, because they have never finished a book.
Right, right. But yeah.
Or everybody's got a number. Yours is 1,000.
I've run into some who, I've been to, gone to school for writing. And there have been people in my class who I swear to you, Ed, were more talented than me. They didn't, though. I think it was like they didn't have a leathery hide and they weren't able to develop it. I think a lot of it too is accepting that not everyone's going to like your work, and accepting that you're going to get rejected, and not taking those rejections as like that just crumble your entire worldview of yourself and who you are as a person. And I think some people just, they didn't have that sort of hard bark, and I don't blame them for it. It's not like, it's not something that I would have thought was so valuable or integral, I think, to the process of being a writer. But because rejection is really a part of this job, and sort of having to pick yourself up off the ground and get out there again, that I think there are so many really talented writers with really important and interesting things to say who just never get the chance to say it because they aren't built, maybe, simply to take the level of rejection that feels almost a necessity hand in hand before you can actually make those small breakthroughs that lead to, successes later on.
Oh, yeah. No, and I get it. There's some people that, their take on it is, I don't have time for this. So, if I'm just like, I don't want this negativity, I'll just do something else.
Yeah. 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 And I think, again, that I would assume that's something that has ideally made them happier individuals having made that choice. I just know that it was at the odd, and there were some who thought they were awesome, and you're like, oh no, but there were some who really truly were awesome, who just weren't built to that specific threshold of just like, I don't give a shit that you don't like it. I'm gonna just find that one considerate pair of eyes who does like it, And from there, I'm going to build towards other considerate sets of eyes, and we're going to sort of get things going. So I guess that's just something that I again, to say to young writers, it's like rejection is part of it. You know, you might hear a story, and every so I almost wish that writers didn't do this, but it's often young writers and new writers who are like, oh no, I just wrote this thing, I kicked it off, and then I found an agent, and they, you know, sold it for $1 million, and it was just like, yeah, smooth sailing. And that, you know, I think that convinces some other starting writers that, well, if it doesn't happen that way, then I'm making some kind of mistake. Because most of the writers I know who I speak to, I face rejection now. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not that everything that I write is unilaterally accepted. It's not that there aren't massive edits that might have to come on something that I write. And I'm not making this sound even less glamorous than it is, but you know, I think that probably is the nature of a great deal of creative endeavor, is that you are facing hurdles, obstacles, and yeah, they probably are predominate at the beginning part of your career, but they don't, for most of us, they don't ever fully, you know, vanish. And they're sometimes they're more painful, because it's like you think you have crossed your last hurdle, and then you find yourself, your feet getting tangled up in one that you weren't expected to hit, and you fall flat on your face, and it hurts even a little bit more.
I think you hit the nail on the head, though. It's like, it's not that you want to discourage people from becoming authors, but you got to go in with open eyes, or else that first rejection, you're just going to crumble.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, for me, I back in the day, this is again dating myself, but I used to like send stuff out in the mail, you know, and you'd wait for hopefully the acceptance, but most normally the rejection, and they would send them on little, you know, slips of paper. And I say I had enough of those that I could have filled a pillowcase and had a very shameful sleep on it, on that crinkly bed of rejection letters. So, you know, that was my journey. And there's others who would, again, be more like, it just sort of clicked immediately. And bless them for that, if that's the case, but that's not mine. And most writers who I speak to, that's not their particular journey either.
Well, you're from Canada. I think we have to blame Nathan Fillion. Because I mean,
for what, for Canada or just for?
Yeah, have you seen Castle?
Yeah, for sure. I love Nathan. I love
you. You've written a best-selling novel at some point, so I'm sure you just have $2,000 in cash sitting in your pocket, right?
I think that there's another thing too, is the notion that if you're a published author, I mean, I had that sense too. I remember my first book got published or picked up for publication. And in a way, my life did change. In a fundamental way, my life did change. It's not that the advance was enough that I, you know, was sort of like jet setting all over the place and buying a yacht. But it was like, it was a major press and more money than I'd ever gotten at one go at any one time. But also it was like, okay, I'm part of this world now, or so I thought. But I also had the misconception that like, you know, my dad was a banker and he got a job at the bank and he just became a banker for 40 years. And my mom got her nursing degree and then she became a nurse for 40 years. And I'm now a published writer and I guess I'll just be a published writer for the next 40 years. And that's not, you know, that is not how it works. You know, you're only as good as your last book and to a degree anyways. And so I certainly, after that first contract, which was a short story and a novel, I found myself persona non grata for a while. And I had to, I guess it's one of those things where you hit that hurdle again and you got to pick yourself up and dust yourself off. And, you know, for me, it was like working some full-time jobs for a while until I could get my next opportunity. I've said it a million times, it's unglamorous for me. Thanks, Nathan. That's not. I would turn my pockets inside out right now and it would be like in a cartoon moth.
It's every week with Sylvain Neuvel and Ian Rogers.
Well, I have played poker with Ian Rogers before. Good dude. I love Ian. But if we did play, it would not be for big stakes.
You gotcha. We're pulling out the quarters and the nickels, guys.
That's right. Nickel poker night.
I remember doing that when I was in the Air Force. So yeah, trust me, I get that one. All right. So getting into your new book, which is The Queen, for anybody who hasn't read it yet, they may not get this thing, but I got to ask you, were you already a big fan of entomology, or did you put in a lot of research for this book?
Well, my first book on Nitkutter, I dealt with tapeworms. And I guess I'm fascinated with that. It's funny. There's nothing like being a writer to sort of pinpoint your obsessions. And I would have been shocked if I had said to you, you know, before writing as Nitkutter, that I had this deep-seated fascination, obsession with insects. I mean, I don't particularly like them. You know what I mean? Like, I find them fascinating, though, at the same level. I'm the sort, you know, me and my son were out digging for worms earlier this summer, and we were like turning over just logs in the forest, you know, looking for them. And, you know, you turn over a dead log and you just, the industry and the sort of disgusting, shadowy, sheltered life that occurs within the soil and within the rot and the loam, most of which is completely unintelligible to me, fills me with a certain sense of loathing and disgust, but also clearly fills me with a sense of, there's a story here. So no, I didn't know much, but I do like researching. I find for all my books, I've done a fair amount of research, it would feel. And I've always said, you just need to be, 1% ahead of 99% of your readers. You need to just know a little bit more about the subject than like most of your assumed readership. And if you're doing so, you're going to come off as, you know, fairly knowledgeable. And if you are right, and I've had, you know, emails to this nature of like when someone who really is an expert will say, come on, man. So I'm like, all right, you got me. But I mean, you got a PhD in this stuff. I don't.
Well, also, this is a horror story. You know, I'm hoping that most of the stuff that happened in this book is not actually possible.
No. I you're right. I'm not challenged. I'm, it's funny as a writer, and maybe you've spoken to this other writers. It's amazing what people will reach out to you with. If I write about guns, there will be people who are real firearms wonks who will tell me that I've gotten the wrong caliber, or that gun doesn't shoot that many cartridges. Or again, I've had people about bees, you know, sort of bee behavior, that this book is wasps, but I've had bees. And I mean, it's often not written to me with any sense of like venom. It's just sort of like, hey, I thought you'd like to know that you're wrong on this.
Because that's what we all want to hear, really.
Well, exactly. I do think there's a certain type of personality who is really well-meaning. But just can't abide that sort of a thing. I think they almost think like, I can't believe this got published without it being sent to like several entomologists I guess if we had more time, you know, I think those people fundamentally misunderstand how much money the publishing industry has to sort of get experts for horror books and stuff. But you know, often I have gone back and re-edited things. So if anyone is watching this and has found something in my work that they find is inaccurate, if you write to me, I may well be able to make that change, providing you're right.
On behalf of most readers everywhere, I feel like there should be a different level of expectation between a horror novel and a peer-reviewed scientific paper. I'm hoping I give you a little more leeway.
I appreciate that, Ed. I appreciate having that little bit of a leash. I will often consult those reviewed journals that you speak of. I mean, often it's gobbledygook to me. It's just way outside of my education level. But I still love the research. I love sort of looking into, the sort of stuff that I do look into for these books. And I find that's a great joy of the writing process.
Well, I have to say too, because there's a whole group of people that always say, write what you know. And I'm thinking if you do that, we've pretty much just gotten rid of the entire horror, fantasy, and science fiction genre, period.
You're making up stuff
that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, like, did you actually live in a haunted house? Were you actually assaulted by a ghoul? Yeah, exactly. You're right. Yeah. I don't see any bite marks in your neck. How can you actually write authentically of vampirism? So no, you're right. And you know, most readers are very tolerant of all that. And maybe only me, because my work sometimes does cross into these, scientific, areas of which I, you know, I'm very clear, as I would say right now, and have said elsewhere, that I'm no expert. And so it really is about like knowing a little bit more than the assumed reader who is reading, and being able to sort of like weave the web of authenticity, or authentic enough that the spell holds for the brace of pages in which they read. But, you know, please don't take me to the MLA conference and start unpacking my work, or, you know, taking it to an entomologist and saying, well, how much of this is actually, you know, verifiably true? Because you will, I won't stand up well under that kind of scrutiny.
Well, also, I know you're married, so I'm pretty sure you've probably not been allowed to make insect hybrids in your basement.
You know? No. Well, I mean, I've tried, you know, with the Cuisinart and the toaster and some of my son's science kit, but it's the experiments have so far had been dispiriting.
All right, I'm gonna make two quick points, and then I'm gonna shut up because I don't want to be the person talking all the time. But I thought you might enjoy these, based on something you said earlier. I did remember talking. I can't remember who the author was, but they wrote a book set, I think, in like 1922, mm-hmm. and somebody wanted to let them know that the motorcycle they referenced wasn't created until 1924. And then the other one that I remember for specifics, you talked about looking things up and knowing things and people asking questions and bringing stuff up to you. Jim Butcher was on last November, and he actually had a time where a SWAT commander came and talked to him to find out who he'd talked to about this setup that he'd done in one of his books, because whoever that is, he said, they know what they're doing and we like to keep tabs on that. And Jim Butcher said that I had to tell him, is like, all I used was Google Earth and my knowledge of
global positioning systems, or
no, the game. I can't remember which game he said now, but okay. It's basically, you know, a military game.
Yeah.
That's what he made this scene up out of. And the guy's just like, oh, I hate the internet.
I mean, that's a cool one. I like that. I've never had someone, you know, sort of someone saying, hey, we need to keep an eye on whoever your sources are there. They need to be monitored. The other one, the whole, that's exactly the sort that I get too. And I think it's just, it just grinds a given reader's gears that sort of due diligence wasn't done. And to them, it's like, well, that could have been so easy that we, you know, you could have chosen a motorcycle that was viable for 1922 or whatever. And you just say, you know, you think to yourself anyways, it's like, I'm, you know, thinking about the emotional resonance of maybe the person who was riding that motorcycle at the time and what he or she is thinking. And it's not at the top of my mind, but there are writers, you know, military inclined writers who really like to get those things accurate, like a Tom Clancy type. So whatever, it's horses for courses. To me, it's like, hey, you took the time to read my book and read it obviously very fastidiously. And these are the conclusions that you have drawn, and I appreciate you bringing them to my notice.
Yeah. I'm much more of, I read a book for enjoyment first. Secondly, I usually like to, because I do this, I usually like to do reviews of them, but I never read them like this is a book report and I've got to find everything that was wrong with this book. I do have to say, and wait till I get there, because it's going to sound funny at the beginning. You took what I usually consider is a bold move with this book, in the fact that you start kind of at the end, which is usually a lot of times that's hard to pull off because you've got to go back now and build this tension when we already know this, you know, this person, at least at this point in the book, is around, et cetera, and so forth. We know some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
And you still, but you pulled it off. You did it well. And the fact that when we go back and we come up to it, we're never at any point where like, I know what's going to happen next because something will happen. Like, nope, didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not sure where in the editorial process. I think at some point the book was straight linear. You know, it starts, you know, with her waking up in the morning, and it sort of carries on through there. And I suppose if I had kept it that way, it would have been fine. I think for me, I've used that technique. I mean, you see that technique in film often. You do see it in short stories, I think. I used a couple of stories, at least one story in my first collection. I did use that technique. You start in medias res, and then you kind of like, it's the, in a movie, it's the one where, you know, you just start at this crazy crime scene or whatever, and bodies are flying around, and then the record scratch happens, and it focuses in on someone. And that's me. John,
6 days earlier.
That's right. That's me, John Scriggins. And I bet you're wondering how I got here. And then, well, let me tell you. And then it rewinds. Yeah, it does the rewind sound. And then you start at 6 days earlier. Right. So it's not that it's an uncommon thing. It's probably maybe less common in fiction, in novels. But as you said, the book goes on from that place too, right?
It's not the very, very end, but it's close.
Yeah, it is. You're right. And so it's a matter of like, bringing readers up to speed, but I guess also sort of trying to weirdly not pull any punches and sort of let readers know what they're in for lack of a better word, because I guess I just wanted to start strong in that, not strong in that, like, I'm going to show you sort of where this is going. And right. If you want to stay on the ride, great. But there's going to be more of this. And if you don't, well, you know, I haven't wasted too much of your time. You can shelf the book and go read something more to your taste.
Well, the funny thing too is I think it's something that we do a lot. I see a lot of this on like YouTube, for instance, people who do the YouTube stuff, where they will start with that first 10 seconds of this big climactic scene. And then they're like, and let's go back to where it started. And then, of course, now you're hooked because you got to figure out how you got there. We don't see it in books as often, but you, like I said, you did it very well. I love the mainly two-person point of view through the whole book.
Yeah.
Paul Jessup's going to kill me for this one because he knows that I hate anything with eyes. And you do have a few of those in there. But I still loved your book. And I think too, what put me over the hump, because you know, I am squeamish about eyes. That's a me thing. Everybody knows that.
I'm not. You like things getting poked or put into it. We're both wearing glasses, so
I can't wear contacts. I can't poke myself in the eye.
Yeah. No, you're right. I don't know. How much money would they have to pay you to? Okay, now I will lightly poke myself in the eye.
Yeah. But the wrap up you did at the end, and I won't give anything away, but I'll just say there are some stuff in the end that are actually coming from other people's point of view that did not exist in the majority of the book. Mm-hmm. And the way that you wrote the ending solidified that book to me as a must read. It's been a little while now, cause I got the audiobook early. Thank you to Libro FM, by the way. I got the audiobook early and I listened to it on that. So I actually finished about the time that it actually dropped.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And like I said, when I finished that though, I just remember thinking to myself, oh my goodness, this is like a perfect ending to that book.
Well, it's bleak, you know, but, I'm glad you think so. I think it's, you know, again, there's nothing like being a writer to discover your obsessions, and they're also probably your aesthetic. And it's not that were we to hang out or, you know, were you to speak to Ian Rogers, I think he would say, yeah, Craig's like a easygoing, like family guy. He does not have a torture dungeon. He is not doing insect hybrid experiments down in his basement, which you would say about most horror writers. In fact, there's probably this sense that we're all insane people when in fact we're, you know, quotidian and almost boring probably for a great deal of us anyways. But I think my aesthetic does bend to most of the Cutter books don't end joyously. Let's say that. And there are some horror books and some horror writers who will take their characters into a bad space, but there's a point of lightness, maybe 50, you know, pages before the end where they conquer the monster. They sort of move towards the light. There is a hopeful, tender ending. My books don't offer that, to myself or to the reader, I guess, generally, but even in my literature side of it, I feel like, you know, life is bittersweet, I think, Ed, just maybe in the way that I look at things, like, and the moments of joy that you get out of it are wonderful, you know, and are as true and as meaningful as I think what the human experience is meant to be, you know, but we don't live in a state of constant grace and happiness. And I think that is nor are we always ennobled by circumstance. So I have a difficult time. Sometimes I feel like to write an ending like that would be untrue to the way that I view the world, I suppose, even though I don't view it nearly as bleakly as the books might suggest I do. I actually like writing about characters where they sort of know it's going to end bad. They hit a point where they're like, we're not going to fix this. And this is probably going to be the end, but they persist in acting humanely and caringly, you know what I mean? And trying to still exhort the best aspects of human nature, even though they realize that even in enacting those things, it's not going to end well. And I think there's something to me anyways, personally, I guess in the way that I must view things, that there's something beautiful about that persistence in the face of, I don't know, annihilation maybe. So in any case, yeah, you wonder, you know, it's like who you are as a writer and who you are as a person. I think people tend to conflate that, and it's completely fair that they would do so because they don't know us as people really. There's sure. Very few options for them to know who we are as people. In any case, and I say, well, maybe I'll just write a happy ending so that I will, you know, so there's not this uniform bleakness to the ends of these books, but, you know, I'm finishing my next one and it's, there's no rainbow at the end of that one either.
Well, I really feel like the Queen ended at a point where it's almost calm before the storm. Like you can see how this is possibly going to go bad, but also everybody's got a half a minute to breathe for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I think that's
Margaret was your main character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. She didn't have a whole lot of time to breathe this entire book.
No. I think that was sort of the point of it, and sort of trying to write with as much forward momentum as possible. Although, you know, you having listened to the book, it's tricky because I did the whole thing within the course of a day, but it ultimately is at least what the thing that really enthralled me about writing it was these two characters and their relationship, but they don't actually meet in the flesh really during the course of the entire book because no. You know, one of them has disappeared a month ago, and the sort of the narrative is the one looking for her essentially. Yep. And being led on a scavenger hunt in terms and hearing her voice and thinking, you know, this is her, but ultimately sometimes it's not her, she's being tricked. So you still have to find that sort of emotional through line between these two characters and why they care for each other and what sort of their history is with one another. And that, I mean, I've said before, and I said it in the acknowledgments, when I was a kid, not a kid, I guess a teenager, living in St. Catharines, which I live in Toronto now. So St. Catharines is about an hour and a half south towards Buffalo. And we had a serial killer who was running around in our city when I was 17, 18, 19. And he killed two girls my age at the time. And not to belabor it, this is not the exact truth of it, as I discovered later. But the way that I set out from writing this book was, I had always thought that one of them was rich and one of them was poor. One of the victims was from a rich family and one was from a poor family. And that's not exactly the case in my further research. But I do think the point holds is that we memorialize, memorialization of people who have gone missing or have been murdered is different depending on wealth disparity sometimes, you know? And I think that was one of the main things that I was interested in writing it, is someone from a poor family can go missing or be murdered, and the outcry doesn't seem to be as big, you know what I mean? Or you know, the sort of response even from authorities is not as voluminous as were someone from a rich family to go missing or suffer that same misfortune. And it's especially bothersome, that's to not sort of not make a big enough point of it, but it's because they're so young, right? Like they're all potential, they're all promise, just like we are at all are at that age. So that one would be seen as having a higher potential than the other, based on nothing that has been clarified yet, because they're too young to sort of have made that next step towards that fulfilling of that potential. There was a part of that narrative that we've written in a state of sort of anger and frustration and kind of rage, and remembering how our city dealt with the loss of those two girls.
Yeah, I feel like the narrative is that the silver spoon automatically gives you a minimum floor of potential.
Yeah, exactly. Like an assumed floor. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And to a degree, I think it stands to reason. Like even for me, I came from a middle class family. As I said, my dad was a banker, my mom was a nurse. They were able to help me get away to university. They had saved up for it, you know. And I had some friends who had just as much intelligence as me, just as much potential, but came from families of a means that didn't have the ability to support them in that way. And so, you know, they went to work at the TRW or the Ford plant. And their lives were significantly different, because I wouldn't say worse, you know, I would never say that for a second, just like different. And I'm very aware of the opportunities that I had based on coming from simply a middle-class upbringing that would not be obviously or readily available to some of the people that I went to school with. So again, yeah, those thoughts were also burbling away in my subconsciousness, or even at the upper levels of my brain as I was writing.
Gotcha. So obviously one thing, and I actually have had Ian on before, Nat Cassidy, we talked last year about the fact that his book dropped like on Halloween last year.
Yeah.
Yours dropped darn close to Halloween.
Is
that always a little bit rough, as in to the point, so to a certain point you're a horror author and that's totally on brand? The other hand, all of those Halloween spooky season people, you know, they read horror, they watch horror during October.
Yeah, we're too late.
You missed it.
Is that what Nat said? Yeah, okay. It's funny. I just finished reading Nat's new book. I got his sent as an arc. I thought it was excellent. I think comes home. It's great, great book for anyone who I guess it's coming out next year. But yeah, I would agree with Nat if that's what he said, because I think to a certain degree, you're right. It was almost better if it'd come out in August, because then it would have had a little bit of forward momentum, and then maybe by Halloween people would have picked it up as their spooky read, potentially. I mean, I'm fine regardless. I think one thing that I guess was a benefit of it is it came out and there were a lot of like radio shows and TV shows up here who needed like, oh, we need, you know, spooky content for the 29th, the 30th, the 31st. So I think I ended up doing a lot of media stuff that I probably wouldn't have necessarily if it wasn't like, oh, yeah, bring the horror writer guy in.
It's August, bring in the horror writer
guy. Bring him in. Yeah, we've already got the, you know, person dressed up as a skeleton, but yeah, get that guy in. So yeah, that part was good. And I mean, I you know, then you guys had something happen, I think like November 5th about that might've destabilized things a tiny bit. Yeah. In the so yeah, but you can never, you know, for me, I don't know how many books I put out at this point. There's never a perfect time to put a book out. You know what I mean? There's never an imperfect time for that matter. You know, I think publishers try and position things in certain ways but you know, you can have a book with all the momentum in the world internally come out and at just the right time and it never hits. And you can have a book that sort of is, you know, dropped at the wrong time potentially and not really supported by the publisher and goes on to just sort of become a grassroots kind of hit. Publishing is a bizarre, it is a bizarre thing to be involved in. So, but I take your point. I think you're right. Definitely around the spooky season, there's just a glut of people looking for scary stuff. And thankfully, there's enough to, you know, fulfill it. But you're right. Coming out on the 29th, I might have been a little bit behind the curve.
Well, it's definitely got a good review from me. I'm loving it. I did want to mention too, the thing I was going to mention about Ian, and I got sidetracked by the Nat Cassidy thing, is of course, obviously, you know, Ian's another Canadian.
Yeah.
And he was my first horror author that was ever on, because I was like big into fantasy for a while.
Good choice.
And I just had to tease him a little bit about, you know, everybody down in the States, just, you know, we think of everybody north of the border are a bunch of nice people. How are you guys writing horror? I mean, you're supposed to be.
I know, we're America's hat, and we're
supposed to be writing Hallmark movies and stuff, you know,
or hockey, you know, sort of hockey narratives. Yeah, well, I don't know. There's a fairly, you know, thriving, you know, cottage industry up here in horror, and it's, I'm trying to think of something like Andrew Piper again has been at it for quite some time up here. Ian, as you've mentioned, Ido van Belcombe in the 90s, I think. So, but you're right. And we have some really good indigenous authors, who some of whom do sort of horror based on kind of their own culture. And I think those are becoming even more sort of recognized and published. We're cold. We're lots of empty, wild, wooded areas. You know, yeah, we're nice. Every so often, we also do incredibly awful things to one another. So, you know, we're not above the horrific.
Oh, and let's face it, we all know how you talk about us behind our back. I'm just kidding.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, you know, not at all. No. Always exciting. It's always exciting being perched atop the wonderful. I mean, I went to school down in Iowa. For a year and a half, I went to
next door. I'm in Nebraska.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, and I love my time in Iowa, and, you know, have an opportunity to have gone down to different, you know, places. When we vacation, I take the family down to America. So, no, you guys are like the madcap uncle who, us stayed, Canadians, sort of look down and wish we could live to the full sort of extent that you guys tend to.
Yeah, I do love the fact, and there's a couple of people, like there's a guy from Josh from England who's a TikToker, and he tries to explain to people in his country, is like, you don't understand, the United States is the size of Europe. So it is completely different groups of people, because it's just like going through Europe and different groups of people. It's freaking huge. And then I think a lot of people, even though they're starting to understand that, I don't think they realize how big Canada is. You guys are probably every bit as big as us. You just have a lot more elbow room.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. We've got, and you know, you go up north, even here in Toronto, which is obviously very populous, but probably 5, 6, 7 hours from here up north. I mean, it gets very thin, very sparse, and you'll get a few like more densely populated areas, but then you get up to the Northwest Territories and the Yukon, and which, you know, Yukon bordering with Alaska. I mean, it's inhospitable, you know? So yeah, we have a lot of land mass, and you're right. We're able to spread out and, keep our own space, I suppose.
That's probably why you're nicer. I mean, I swear traffic is what does most of it to Americans. we get mean when we get behind a wheel.
Oh yeah, well, you know, again, here in Toronto, it's like, I think we're 7 million here, so we are it's rough. I totally understand, but I mean, this is the biggest city I've lived in by far, and my wife comes from a small town, and I've lived in mid-sized cities normally, so there is definitely many a day when my wife will come home from work after battling traffic or the commute, you know, with the subway, and just like, we gotta buy a farm.
I grew up in Phoenix, so I understand the big city issue. So the only major city I've been to, we stopped in Vancouver a couple of years ago.
Beautiful city. Yeah.
Very nice. Other than that, my wife loves Banff, by the way.
I love Banff too. Banff. I used to live in Calgary, so that was like an hour from Banff. But it's just the mountains in general. You know, you pay another $500,000 for a mountain view because the restorative view of the mountains. I'd be the same looking at the ocean, I think. It's just sort of human calmness sort of takes over you when you're looking at something with that kind of majesty.
Yeah, my wife's all about the scenery, and hopefully, if she gets lucky, a few mooses.
You'd find them in, bears rucking around in the garbage cans in Banff. It's an uneasy alliance with the wilderness there.
Fair point. All right. So one thing I want to mention, it's getting late, and I just wanted to bring this up real quick. If anybody's watching this or sees this soon, I don't guarantee that it's only good through today, but I do know that this dropped yesterday, and it's already half sold out. If you go to Earthling Publications, they do have a very special edition of Little Heaven for sale. I believe the numbered edition is 235 copies, and it goes for $250. And the lettered edition, I think there was only like, was it 13 copies or so? There's not very many lettered copies. And those I didn't even see a price on. I think it said email for price, which told me I was out. So, but can you tell anybody a little bit about Little Heaven, just in case anybody's interested? Because it is a gorgeous cover.
It is beautiful. It's and Paul at Earthling does awesome work, and Glenn, who did the interiors, as you can sort of see there, he did a fantastic job. Like some of the best artwork I've ever been fortunate enough to have for a book. It was my crack at kind of a neo-Western. I read and watched a ton of Westerns growing up and into my adult years, and wanted to write something that sort of had that feeling. So it's like a cult Western, let's say that, I had a great deal of fun writing it, and Paul just did a absolutely bang up job on it. As you're saying, like those, he just does great work. I don't know if you have some of his,
I don't, I think I got on Earthling Publications list because I think he did one of Ian Rogers' books.
Yeah.
And I snagged that.
Okay. Yeah. I think Ian's got some others coming out with Paul. I have one right here. Let me see here. Paul sent it to me.
Gotcha. And if anybody's watching this, by the way, I did already put the Earthlings publication link down in the description if you want to check out that book.
This is, I believe this is Malerman's The Institute. Oh, Inspection. Sorry. So by Josh Malerman. But. It's just a fantastic book. Like it's a fantastic book on its own, but it's also a fantastic just piece of, I'm not a huge book collector. I collect a lot of books, but I don't collect sort of in these sort of valuable editions. But if you are into that sort of a thing, I don't think there's many people doing it better than Paul is.
Yeah, I think I dropped the money on, I think this one was the Earthling publication one.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was the only way I could get it. There is no other edition of this book.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And as you know, if you're a fan of Ian, as am I read Sycamore, which is coming out. I'm not sure who it's coming out from, but I really enjoyed that.
Is that here yet? I swear. Hey, I thought I think I've got Sycamore somewhere.
Oh, is it released already? Okay. Yeah.
It's either here and I'm just missing it, or it's on its way. I can't remember which.
Yeah. You'll
also picked up. I got Every House of the Haunted.
Oh yeah. Brilliant.
I've had Supernatural for a while. Yeah. I fell in love with the whole Blacklands thing.
Me too. Yeah. And then Sycamore is a sort of, continuing on that, saga and that world. So, and he's a super fun writer, sort of like, I sort of like Jim Butcher almost, in that way I've got is sort of like wisecracking, in a really sort of great way that moves the story along. But when he gets creepy, he gets real creepy.
Yeah.
So yeah, always a fan of Ian Rogers.
Gotcha. All right. So you said you've got a book you're writing right now. Is there anything you can tell us about it?
Sure. I mean, the next cutter one is like, I'm fascinated with, my dad went through a health scare, and I've, had people who have, I mean, we're just at that age, I suppose, Ed, where we've lost some people and people are getting ill. It's getting bleak, right? But I became fascinated with the idea of regenerative medicine and the Fountain of Youth. There's this guy, he's this millionaire, billionaire, maybe Timothy something or other, Timothy Johnson, I'm going to say, who is basically becoming his own guinea pig of trying to see how long he can extend his life. you know, blood transfusing himself and eating this crazy diet and, you know, sort of doing, undergoing all these therapies, which I'm not like, hey, go for it. Like, you know, fill your boots if that's what you'd like to do. I'm interested to see how that's going to work, but like, can you live to 120? Can you live to 140? But there was this article that I read about biological immunity or biological immortality, which is there are certain creatures, jellyfish, that are actually able to live forever. And I thought, well, wouldn't that be interesting if there's a way that human beings could live forever? But because it's a Nick Cutter story, of course, it doesn't end harmoniously. So yeah, it's an idea of these people getting invited to this retreat to have this opportunity to see if they can, you know, reverse their age and potentially live forever.
I don't need to live to be 140. I would just like my 17-year-old knees back.
I'd like my 17-year-old a lot of bodily parts back, but yeah, start with the knees and the ankles, but eyes would be nice too, maybe.
Fair. Yes, these have gotten thicker over the years, but I have to admit though, my 17-year-old knees were probably helped out a lot more by my 17-year-old waistline.
Right.
A lot less to carry around.
It's all linked together. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I go and play basketball still like a couple times a week, pick up, and you know, my son's into it now too. And I'm just like, dude, just enjoy playing something because you love it. Cause now every time I play it, there's a toll. I still love it just as much as I always did, but there's ice and there's like anti-inflammatories and there's at least a beer to sort of like cover up the, you know, the sort of pain. But that's, you know, that's fine. You sort of, you get one body and you drag it through the world, and it doesn't have to be pretty at the end.
Yeah, I don't think we hurt ourselves any worse than we did when we were younger. It just takes forever to heal.
You got it. Yeah, I did a shoulder thing, and it's like, when is this going to get better, right? But there was this Louis C.K. comedy thing, and he did his ankle, and he went, when's it going to get better? He's like, no, well, what's the matter with it? Well, you're old. It's like, well, do you have a pill or anything? No, you're old. It's like, that's it. So in any case, yeah, there's no use really complaining about it, but I do find the idea of and there's so many people who are looking. I looked into, you know, there are people there, Peter Thiel and some others are spearheading like $1 billion you know, sort of objectives to try and see just how long we can live as human beings. So there's a great amount of effort, not surprisingly, really, going into life prolonging therapies. And then you get into that really moral question of like, well, how long does any human really ought to live? You know, what actually happens to the fabric of society if you have people living 500 years? Like, there actually are some trickle down effects of that would change society in ways that we're not even really able to grasp. So sort of the notion that like maybe we're given this amount of time on earth, and it feels tragically short often, but you know, make the best of the moments and days and years that you're given.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it till just now, but I think I finally figured out Brandon Sanderson, Elantris. He didn't write that book about a cursed city. He just wrote it about a city of a bunch of 40 plus year olds. You get hurt, it just doesn't heal.
I haven't read that one, but that's, yeah.
That was book one in the whole.
Okay. Well, maybe he was going through something, Brandon. Just had to, you know, you work it out on the page.
All right. So I've had you more than an hour, which always seems to happen with horror authors for some reason. I don't know what it is about y'all.
Bloviators.
Ian Rogers was my first one. I had him on for 90 minutes and we finished, and I won't do this to you. We finished recording and he was on for another 90 minutes. He and I were just talking afterwards.
He and loves finally,
I'm like, dude, too. Your wife is waiting. Right. Oh man. But thoroughly love that. So a couple of follow-up questions I always ask for everybody. And by the way, if anybody wants, obviously we talked a little bit about Little Heaven. If you want a beautiful book, pick up Little Heaven. If you want a fast horror read, and I can't really say this from an audiobook perspective because you can only speed it up so fast, but for a book that doesn't stop start to finish, which is one of those ones to me where that's one of those one more chapter books. Some books have slow, long chapters, and you read one and you're like, I need to go do something else. It takes you a week to finish the book.
Right.
The Queen is very much like, well, crap, what's happening next? Because it just doesn't stop beginning to end. Definitely pick up The Queen if you haven't already picked it up yet. But what else is Nick Cutter / Craig Danielson reading right now?
What am I reading? Well, I said I read When the Wolf Comes Home. I really enjoyed that. I'm reading a lot of, I get sent stuff, arcs. So a lot of that is sort of, I feel like not professional duty or obligation. It's sort of like I was very fortunate to have people blurb me, and it feels fair and right to do the same service, you know, for people. And I'm also just interested in seeing what, you know, is new over the transom in the horror world. So I have one over here called, let me go get them just quickly. So I, okay. They're just here behind me. So I can get everything right. Oh, wait, sorry. There's When the Wolf Comes Home. Okay. So yeah, one is Bad Eater by Kylie Lee Baker. Who?
That one, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't. She's not a horror writer by trade. I think she writes, you know, in another genre, but she, you know, probably like me, had this idea that like, well, that ain't part of the genre that I, you know, started in. So yeah, I just started it, this one, and the writing is fantastic, and I'm sure I will probably read a great chunk of it tonight once we're done here. And then the new Chuck Wendig here, Staircase in the Woods, which I like Chuck a great deal. I think he's a force of good for the genre. And I haven't read enough of him actually. So I aim to rectify that by reading this after I'm done Bad Eating.
Nice. Yeah, the only thing I know about Chuck Wendig is all of last year I saw apples everywhere on the internet because that Orchard book he wrote.
Right.
And the fact that Shauna McGuire still hasn't forgiven him for not going out in the cornfields and having an egg fight with her. That's
well, I don't know the whole etymology of that story, but yeah. Shame on Chuck for not having an egg fight with
That's what Shauna said.
In a cornfield. Yeah. I mean, when you get invited to an egg fight in a cornfield,
the only Chuck did respond to that to me once and said, because it's the only conversation we've really had, something about the fact that nobody survives going into a cornfield with Shauna McGuire, so he wasn't going to do it.
So. Well, you know, whatever. Discretion being the better part of valor. Now I don't blame him.
All right. And then other thing I like to ask, is there a hobby or skill other than your illustrious boxing career that you wish more people knew about you?
A hobby or skill? I wish I could, you know, it's funny because I think a lot of the Cutter books get some criticism, fairly so, for the treatment of animals. I'd like to find my cat Spell. She's, oh, here she is. Give me a sec.
Has she read your last book? She's hiding.
She maybe be camera shy. Hey, you be camera shy? We adopted her. So
nice.
May, how you doing, Spell? So, just so people know, I don't plan any evil to this cat. I don't plan to do any. when we get off this, Ed, I'm not going to do something cruel to my cat. So, yeah, maybe it's good for people to know that we love animals in this household. And, we've had lots of a little menagerie because obviously kids are always coming home with frogs and tadpoles and everything else, and we try our best to make sure that they are released to the wild in the same state in which they came in.
I think Brad's alluding to the fact that you're not going to do any research on the cat.
No, that's right. That is not a research cat. That is a house. I don't have research cats. So,
if anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about with the whole boxing thing, if you go to Craig's website, and I'll get a link to that in the description. It's not there yet. You did have a couple of, shall I say, celebrity boxing matches with a couple of authors back in the day?
Yeah, they were, I was just fortunate enough to have two guys who wanted to punch me in the face. And we sort of agreed that we would do so. And you can't really fake a boxing match, despite what Jake Paul and Mike Tyson might have put on.
I was about to say, right? That may be the wrong day to say that.
Exactly. In my experience, I was not able to fake a boxing match. So yeah, I fought a poet, probably the biggest poet you could find in Canada. They found him in a lumberjack camp or something and brought him down to fight me. And that didn't go well. And then I fought Jonathan Ames, who was a lovely man and a very tough son of a bitch, in New York the next year. And I lost both matches, but I got myself in shape and discovered some things about myself. That I don't particularly like getting punched in the face or other parts of my body. But I like the training, and I do consider it sort of a fun, weird sojourn you gotta bleed to do the thing you love, I guess.
We will have to give you credit though. I saw the photos, especially at the end. You didn't look like one of those celebrity matches like, you know, Refrigerator Perry or Screech. You looked like you put in the work and you.
I did. I was actually down in Iowa, and there were two. I went just to a club and said, hey, I'm basically going to get in a fight in like 6 months, and I don't know anything about it. I need help. And he was training two Olympic boxers, the Klinefelter sisters, Katie and Aaron. And they kicked the hell out of me, so after that, even though I knew I had to get in the ring with this much bigger poet lumberjack boxer, I don't know. I felt like the Klinefelter sisters sort of hardened me up, toughened me up. That I'm like, oh, whatever, do your worst. The Klinefelters have already kicked the crap out of me. What can you do?
No, I get that. I know that physically, men are usually stronger than women. I also know that Ronda Rousey would tie me in a pretzel. So, you know, it's.
Yeah, those women were surgical. They would just, you know, not big clubbing blows. It was like, fighting someone with a scalpel for hands, you know, just a lot of surgical cuts. So in any case, yeah, long time ago. It's funny even to think about it. But yes, that was part of my early career.
Nice. All right, so two more questions. I got us followed up. One, and this is kind of a freebie question, but I always like to ask authors, was there anything you thought you'd want be asked or something you just wanted to talk about that we haven't covered?
No, that's a great, I'm appreciative of you asking that, but I feel like this has been a very wide-ranging and interesting interview, so I'm going to say negatory.
Not a problem. And then lastly, I am not an Amazon hater. But I am a huge stan for local independent bookstores. Is there a brick and mortar store, maybe something in Toronto or something around, just a local one that you want to give a shout out to?
There are a lot. I would say anyone here in Toronto probably who is a book lover will know Type is a great one. There's a couple Type bookstores in the city. There's Backup Books, which it caters to genre. There's Little Ghosts, which is specifically... Nice. For horror, and that's a lovely bookstore run by two very dedicated, awesome people. Again, forces of good for the genre. Book City. There's Book Cities around, which is another independent bookstore just local to the city, a chain. So thankfully, it's fairly thriving here. We do have an Indigo, which is kind of Barnes and Noble sort of idea. Yeah, and I mean, whatever. At this point, it's like, hey, listen. Anything that is a brick and mortar selling books is good. But if I were recommending, yeah, it'd be like little, especially for horror, it'd be Little Ghosts.
Yeah. And I just remind people all the time, yes, I have Amazon affiliation. I also have Libro.fm affiliation. But I always tell people, if you've got a local independent bookstore, check there first. And I will, not tonight because I woke up way too early, but tomorrow I will go back through this video. And I will make sure that I get links to all of the books and bookstores that you mentioned also down in the description below.
Awesome. Sounds great, Ed.
So I appreciate you doing this. It was kind of a, fortuitous timing. We were both free since, this one kind of pulled itself together quickly. But like I said, once I read that book, I listened to that book, I definitely had to do a little more research on you, see what else you had. And that kind of got us in contact with each other. And I really think more people need to be reading this book if they haven't read it already.
I appreciate it. It was lovely chatting with you. And yeah, as you said, fortuitous. So lovely meeting you.
All right. And as always, thank your wife for giving you up for the evening.
I will. She just jumped in. She was out at the gym. She was pumping iron. So, but I will. I'll say thank you for allowing Ed into our home for this. Yeah.
The random guy you've never met on the internet wanted to thank you for giving up your husband for the night. Got it.
That's okay. She's very understanding.
And I know if Brad had a question, he's not shy. He would have spoken up. So, gonna call it a night. Like I said, I'm gonna have by tomorrow morning, I'm gonna have links to all of Craig's stuff, although it'll probably still say Nick Cutter just because I think that's who people know as.
Yeah.
And all that good stuff. So appreciate everybody stopping in. I have seen the numbers go up and down, so I do know that there's been some people checking it out, but these always seem to do better after they've been up for a while anyhow. And I am looking forward to your next book and maybe going to find one of those previous ones I hadn't seen yet.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for having me once again.
Right. Have a good night, Craig.
Take care.